It's by the No One Is Legal campaign in Montreal, and it's featuring Charlie Wolf Smoke, who's an Indigenous organizer based right now in Regina. It's an honor to have him here tonight. He's been fighting back against the Canadian authorities for quite some time now, and we here in Montreal have also been engaged in supporting that struggle to some degree. And tonight he's going to be speaking about resistance to immigration authorities here in Canada. Over the last year, they've tried a number of things, from harassing his family to deporting him to the United States unsuccessfully, and everything you can imagine, abducting him at his home in front of his children. And Wolf has declared himself as pre-Canadian. And we're going to be looking into the concept of open borders on stolen land, as the land we are sitting on tonight is stolen land. And Sarita Ahuja, who is also with No One Is Illegal, is going to be speaking about solidarity work, how allies can work to build this struggle to fight against this onset of colonialism and genocide, which is still occurring today in 2002 across Turtle Island. So once again, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming, and take it away, Sarita.
So as a member of the No One Is Illegal campaign, and as someone who's been involved in various political initiatives over the years that strive to build genuine solidarity between settler societies and native peoples here in Canada, or what's known as Canada, and in Latin America, I welcome you to this discussion. Open borders on stolen land. It's a new discussion for many people. I think in Canada, in Montreal, in North America. But it's a new discussion, and it's only a beginning, because I think it's going to be something that more and more we're going to have to reckon with. And my words will be brief, because I can't really replace Ellen Gabriel, who was supposed to speak this evening, but unfortunately she can't be with us tonight. So I'm just going to bring up some points that I think that we need to be conscious of. Because in terms of contributing to the ways in which we go about building a social movement that really seeks to strengthen liberation struggles and self-determination for all peoples, I think we have a lot of work to do, but we also have a lot of places from where we can start already. We have a good base to start from. And when we're building this movement that recognizes self-determination for migrants, for native peoples, for immigrants, for the dispossessed and the excluded and the uprooted, I think what we need to keep in our hearts is this idea of that we want to cultivate a culture of resistance. And this culture of resistance has to be rooted in a deep respect for diversity. The idea that the way we're going to get out of this is that we're going to do it all together, or no one's going to get out. And it's going to be based on mutual aid and solidarity and a profound commitment to making a world where all worlds can flourish, as the Zapatistas have declared many times. And I think it is still something that we have to continue to strive for. Saying it over and over again will make sure that we can, you know, continue to do that. And it's also about affirming a struggle, because it is a struggle, where we are asserting our rights as we are fighting to defend the right to fight. It happens simultaneously. And so that when we engage and we confront the state, we understand that this is a struggle. And when we wrestle with this huge, imposing legal apparatus that circumscribes our lives on a day-to-day basis, whether you are a native, whether you are a settler or a migrant, we also have to be thinking of how to build our political alliances and our relationships among us all in a way that changes the very terms of who gets to be free, of who is served justice, and who is determining what is dignity. So I'd like to share with you one story of a man who has forged a way that I think that we can take inspiration from. And Wolf Smoke, is going to be also sharing with us his story. But there's this one fellow in near Sarnia, Ontario. His name is Maynard George, and he's a Chippewa man from Stony Point. And over the years, he's been giving landed immigrant status to over 80 people, mostly from China and the Middle East. And, who, you know, these people are considered illegal by the United States and by the Canadian state. And he's been giving them landed immigrant status by adopting them, so making them his children, and also making them part of the sovereign Chippewa nation, which is at Stony Point, which is also a site of where people, you know, took the stand, expropriated the land back from the Canadian state. It's a site where the Canadian state had confiscated it during the years to build a military state, a military base, sorry. So this Maynard George, I just want to read something out of a file that he has presented to both the INS and Canadian Immigration and Citizenship. And in his file, where he's proving the adoption status, he writes, "Receipts of gifts deemed as tokens of love and affection have been received by this family and this First Nation. We, taking the same into our royal consideration, do hereby grant and convey, and we do extend access to our people's Turtle Island, commonly called North America." So this is kind of the declaration that he's been giving to these people that have been granted. A lot of them have been granted also, as he's successively lobbied both the Department of Immigration here in Canada and the INS. He's basing himself on a treaty from 1850, but also he's basing himself on the principle and the belief and the conviction that today's fight for self-determination happens on all levels, every day, all the time. And it includes making them recognize treaties. It includes asserting First Nations jurisdiction, and it includes the recognition of Aboriginal title. But as Smoke will also tell us, it includes using their laws to expose their hypocrisy. It also includes using our own laws, our own mandates created by our people's movement that we will forge together in order to delegitimize the authority of the state. And it also includes building this people's movement in a way that respects and reclaims our rights on our own terms. And that's basically what I had to say before I pass the word to Wolf Smith.
To begin with, I want to thank everyone for coming here, and especially I want to thank everyone who has, Stefan, Harsha, everyone who has organize this event, everyone who has shown solidarity with me and gone out of their way here in Montreal to show support for me. Personally, actually, I feel like the people with the Indigenous People Solidarity Movement and No One Is Illegal, to me, those people are more heroes. The way that I see it, what I'm doing is basically what I've always done. I've never been smart enough or brave enough to walk away from a fight. So when someone pushes me, I always push back. But people in Montreal and other cities that are showing their support for me and demanding accountability from their government on my behalf are the heroes, because it's the first time I've been to Montreal. Jaggy and Stefan have never met me before, but yet they've put quite a bit of effort into supporting me. When I first heard from Stefan about this, I was really surprised about, I guess, just over a month ago, the first action that happened here in Montreal. Honestly, I was overwhelmed by it. I didn't expect it, and didn't really know what to think about it. It also kind of restores my faith in the human race. I don't really think that much about my species, really. I'm a biologist and a horseman. I don't like being labeled a political activist, because that sounds like a, you know, a job or a hobby that some people choose, and I would really rather not be doing this. I went to college in a conservation biology program. I worked in national parks with bison, and I relate to animals quite a bit better than I do with people. I find that bison or horses are more humane than human beings are. And to me, it seems a more intelligent choice of life to spend my time around horses than dangerous and fairly unintelligent human species. In fact, if Canada Immigration had not ordered me to return to South Dakota, then long ago I would have returned to South Dakota on my own. In fact, when Immigration Canada came to my school in Regina on June 19, 2001, it was a day before the last day of school, and my contract was up in like 24 hours after they appeared, and shortly after that, I was going to return to South Dakota. I wanted to go back before I developed this northern accent again and to be around, you know, normal talking folk, and to go back to my horses and to go to a more hospitable climate that's not covered in snow from November till May every year. But of course, they came in and said, well, you have to leave, and then I had no choice now but to stay. And now it's starting to snow again. Well, another point to this, too, is that I'm the one Indian who has been in the news fighting immigration, but I'm not the only person. I guess I lucked out because of the timing of my case. It's the first time in my life I've ever had good timing on anything, thanks to the World Trade Center deal and the reactionary measures enacted after that. Basically, what happened was the media needed something to counter what the United States and Canadian governments were doing at the border and what they were saying as far as immigration. And so then they look around the country and they say, well, here's an Indian person who is a family man and a science teacher. You know, ideal situation. We're going to play him against the Canadian government's efforts at tightening up the border. So, you know, I sold quite a few newspapers for them. I have a friend out in Burnt Church. I always have a hard time with his name. I call him G.K. There's like, you know, his name is like this long printed out. He's been dealing with this situation for more than 15 years now. There's another guy that I met in British Columbia by the name of Robert Watt from the Senex Nation, and he's been dealing with similar situation for quite a few years and has to walk back and forth from the States into British Columbia through the mountains just to be able to get into his own home. Neither one of these guys get national film coverage. And there's quite a few other people. If you go back about 80 years, then you'll find the story of a man named Discahe, or Levi General, who actually it's kind of funny, but Levi General is one of the historical figures that I looked up to when I was young. What happened was in the early 1920s, Levi General was a traditional chief from Six Nations Reserve. He was a Cayuga nationalist, not a so-called Canadian Aboriginal, but a real Indian. And he was chosen as a spokesperson for the Six Nations Council, and they asked him to go to Geneva to talk to the League of Nations and to inform the world as to what Canada was doing, trying to impose citizenship upon us, attempting to abolish our legal forms of government or traditional forms of government, and attempting to impose their elective system government upon us, which is odd because their government is actually a failed attempt at copying our government. And so then they want to take away the government that inspired their government and impose a corrupted form of government that is kind of like an illegitimate grandchild of our government to begin with. So, of course, because a Levi general wanted to go to Geneva and tell everybody about Canada's genocide against Indian people, Canada refused to give him a passport. Rather than just giving up, or rather than begging Canada over and over, the Six Nations government created a passport, the first and probably the only actual indigenous passport, and they issued one to Levi General. Levi General traveled then from the Grand River to Geneva on a Haudenosaunee Six Nations passport. Now, for someone to do that today in 2002 would be a risky thing and a fairly brave thing for someone to do. But I think for someone to do this in the 1920s was incredible. So in my mind, you know, I see Levi General as being one of the bravest men to live in the past 150 years. He went there and exhibited extreme fortitude because he had to wait in Geneva for an extremely long time. Every time that another country would sponsor him, or whatever the term is, to get him on the floor, the United States would do something to pull the rug out from under him. And he waited there. Finally, the media came to his rescue, and they started putting the story across the world. And then these supreme and wise world leaders from all these colonial countries decided, well, you know, now we look like idiots, you know, we better let him have the floor. So he explained, he said his piece, and when he returned from Switzerland, he got into New York State, and when he attempted to cross near Niagara Falls to get back into what some people call Ontario, Canadian officials refused to allow him to cross. He had a farm at Six Nations Reserve. He was a traditional chief from Six Nations Reserve. He had a wife and children who he had not seen for quite a long time. And they turned him back. And they never allowed him to return. And he had to go to his friend's house south of this imaginary border, a man by the name of Clinton Rickard, who was a chief on the Tuscarora Reservation. And he was already lonesome and homesick from the time, you know, that he had to sacrifice from his family in Geneva. And to get so close and not be able to see his children, you know, had a profound effect on Levi General. He got sick. Also, like me, he didn't trust white doctors, and he wanted his doctor from his own culture, from Six Nations, to come and treat him. And at the border, these immigration people wouldn't allow a traditional doctor from Six Nations to go into New York to treat him. And eventually he died in the late 20s in Clinton Rickard's home on the Tuscarora Reservation. And supposedly the last words of Levi General were "fight for the line," meaning the imaginary border on the 49th parallel. And so when I got involved with this situation, you know, fighting this illegitimate line, it seemed funny to me that I basically ended up being included in the same fight that Levi General had after he, you know, had inspired me for so many years when I was younger. But for some reason, in my case, the mainstream media decided to broadcast me across the country. They had never done this, like I said, with Robert Watt or with my friend J.K. out in Burnt Church. So as a result of that, I've been traveling around quite a bit, talking to people. And in the prairie region where I live, it's difficult because there's not a lot of activism amongst Indian people. In Saskatchewan, and this is also one of the reasons why my case exists, in Saskatchewan, the Indian population there is, the percentage is larger than any other territory, state, or province in North America. Right now, the Indian population in Saskatchewan is at least 13% of the overall population. And some demographic studies that were conducted a couple of years ago showed that at the rate our population was growing in Saskatchewan. In another 20 years, the Indian population is expected to exceed 30% of the overall population. What they didn't take into consideration, though, is that in Saskatchewan, the non-Indian population is leaving the province at increasing rates every year to go to Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia for jobs. So in reality, if these trends continue in another 20 years, the Indian population in Saskatchewan could easily exceed 50% of the overall population. And the government makes quite a bit of money off of Saskatchewan, especially in the north with lumber and with the uranium that they're using to develop bombs to drop on everybody else across the world. So they can't risk having the Indian people regain control over their land or even to have a strong voice, you know, in what happens there. So they have to make sure to subdue any outspoken Native people in that area so that they can continue controlling us. Now, what happened with my case, if you're not real familiar with the particulars, I had lived in Saskatchewan before, but I left in the mid-90s, returned to South Dakota, and about 2 years ago, I came back to Regina for a visit. While I was there, I was encouraged to apply for a job at a local high school as a counselor. I didn't want to. This was first week of November 2000. I wasn't particularly interested in taking this job because I knew that in another week or two it was going to get cold up there and I wanted to go back to South Dakota. So what I decided was, well, I'll apply for the job. If I get it, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'm going to go home. And I'm not going to call up, you know, and work real hard at getting this job. So I gave them my application and figured that they weren't going to call me. Unfortunately, they called me back right away and they said that they wanted me to start on Monday. So then I kind of had no choice but to stick around. When I started, I was working in student support services at this school as a counselor and a liaison between the school and Native families. At the school that year, there were only three students that were non-Native. Every other student in the school was Native. There were no Indian teachers working in this school, though there still aren't. After I had been working there for a couple of months, the assistant superintendent of schools faxed a copy of my resume to the principal and vice principal and suggested that I should be teaching science. I wasn't a certified teacher, but with my conservation biology program and with the previous jobs I'd had with the National Park Service, they had me co-teaching grade 9 science. And at University of Regina, there's a program to where if you already have a degree in a particular field, like a science field, you can transfer your credits to U of R. You take 4 teaching methods classes, do an internship, and you know, then you get, then you can be a certified teacher. And as the plans were going, it should have been like within, after the summer taking classes and the following fall, I should have been certified as a teacher, and then I was guaranteed a full-time position teaching science at Scott Collegiate. When I first applied for this job, I went to HRDC and I asked for, I tried to apply for a social insurance number, and I don't have a birth certificate, and so I took all the identification documents that I had. I have American Social Security number. I have, you know, basically everything except for a SIN number and a birth certificate. And a person that I spoke to phoned to New Brunswick and said that, well, if you can get a notarized statement saying that you have never been baptized and a copy of your marriage license from South Dakota, then we'll use that and everything else you have and we'll give you a social insurance number. I thought it would only take a couple of weeks, but of course it took the BIA over a month, I think over 2 months, to find my marriage certificate. I'd been married about 5 years before that, and they finally accidentally found my marriage certificate sitting on someone's desk in Pine Ridge. It had never been filed. Indian Affairs in Canada runs basically about the same way, too. I got that information finally, and they had changed their mind. They weren't going to give me a social insurance number. At that point, my wife wanted me to quit my job, but I enjoyed it too much, and so I said, well, no, I'm not going to quit. So I kept working. When tax time came around, they saw that the SIN number was registered to Elisa Big Eagle, but then there's a Charlie Smoke using it. And so they came at the school, they interviewed me, they didn't tell the principal, the school board, anyone why they were coming to see me. They asked me if I used her number. I said yes. They interviewed me. We had about an hour, hour and a half discussion. And they said, well, we're not going to tell anyone why we came to see you, and we're not asking you to quit your job, but we'll take all this information to our supervisors and see what we can do for you now. And so, all right, I went back to work. This was end of April. And May, I didn't hear anything from them. June 20th was our last day of school. And when June rolled around, I figured when my contract is up in June, I'm going to go back to South Dakota, so wasn't really concerned with it. The last week of May, though, the principal suggested that because we had almost entirely Native student population at this school, and since National Aboriginal Day was June 21st, which was the day after our school ended, they suggested that I bring in material, guest speakers, whatever, throughout the month of June, and we'd celebrate National Aboriginal Day every day of June. And so I tried to bring in material from as many, you know, varied sources as possible. One of the things that I did was I played on the internet in the library, I played a Native America Calling show that discussed the takeover of the tribal building in Pine Ridge about a year before that. People on reservation got tired of lack of accountability from the leadership, and a group of people got together, called themselves the Grassroots Oyate, or the Grassroots People, marched into the tribal building, ordered the chief and council out of their offices, put padlocks on their doors, and then occupied the building until the BIA and the FBI agreed to have independent auditors do an audit on the previous two administrations. I played an hour-long radio show on that. I talked to them about that, and then I got a video from the library downtown that Robert Redford put together called Incident at Oglala. This video is fairly well-known. A lot of you may have seen it. It was made on Leonard Peltier's situation, and the incident at Oglala that the title is talking about refers to a shootout on June 26, 1976, where two FBI agents, in my opinion, committed suicide on Pine Ridge Reservation. And the reason that, and I always explain why I call it a suicide, they call it a murder, and of course they tried to pin the death on Leonard Peltier. But Pine Ridge is not like a Canadian reservation. It's a huge area, and there's about 30,000 people living on Pine Ridge. And it's also a pretty active reservation also. So for two white FBI agents to go into the middle of Pine Ridge, especially in the 1970s, and pull guns on Indians is basically a definite way to commit suicide. I mean, if they would have tried to hang themselves, you know, they could have thrown a rope over a rotten beam, it could have broken, they could have survived, or if they would have used a gun, they could have missed and just disfigured themselves. But to, at that time, to go into that area on Pine Ridge and start shooting at Indians, there's a guarantee that they're going to end up dead. Shortly after I showed that film, two agents from Citizenship Immigration Canada and a local cop came into the school, started arguing with me. They demanded that I quit my job. I refused. Then they said that they were going to set up a hearing within 2 weeks, and that at this hearing I would have to prove to them that I had a right to work and live in Canada. And I told them that they had it backwards, that when they set up the hearing, that they're going to have to prove to me that they have a right to work in Canada. At this point, they started swearing, and it got kind of ugly in there. At this point, too, the principal, none of the administration was aware why HRDC had been to the school a couple of months before that, why immigration agents were there on that day. The principal was in a meeting with one of the board members, and these two immigration agents marched into her office and ordered her, "You have to let Smoke go." And she said, "Well, I don't think you have authority to tell me who I can hire or fire in my school." The agents were totally flustered that two people had actually resisted them that day. And they stood in the hallway for a long moment with their mouths hanging open. Finally, they contacted the personnel director at the school board and said that, "Well, you know, we're federal officials, and until this matter is cleared up, he can't work in Canada anymore." So the personnel director said, "Well, I have to talk to the superintendent." And about 10 minutes later, she phoned the principal and said, "Well, okay, you have to let him go." This is about 3 o'clock on June 19th, and the principal was upset, but she told me, "Well, you're off the clock now. Your job's been terminated." It was, like I said, the day before the last day of school, and I didn't want to upset the students, and there were a few things that I wasn't quite finished with yet, so I said, "Well, I'll finish off the rest of the school year," which was one more day, "as a volunteer. And when all the kids have left the school at the end of the day tomorrow, I'll clean out my office and turn in my keys." And she said, "Okay," so I did that. I waited for about 5 weeks. After that, I never heard from immigration. I phoned them up. I asked them what happened to the hearing that they were supposed to schedule within 2 weeks. And they were a little surprised that I phoned. And they said, "Well, we'll have it, within, by Friday, a date will be set." So I waited. Friday came. I didn't hear from them. And I should back up, too. Also, on June, right after the June 19th incident, the same cop came back to the school with a subpoena or summons, whatever you call it, for me to show up in provincial court in Regina on June 26th for using a false social insurance number. And I thought that was kind of odd because, generally it takes a couple of months or longer for a person to get his first court date. For me, a date was scheduled immediately. It was 7 days after the visit with immigration. And what had made it more unique was that my court date was set for June 26th, which was the anniversary of the shootout at Oglala. I went in, it was adjourned for 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, I went in, it was adjourned again. Every time from June 26th until early September, the court case was adjourned for anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. And after that, I never heard anything. No more court dates were set after September. I had a lawyer that came up to me in Regina and volunteered his services on this false SIN number charge. And through the whole time, he kept saying that, "Well, the judge is going to throw it out eventually." And then just after the September 11th bombing, I met with this lawyer downtown on September 13th, 2001. And as a joke, I told him, "Well, how much you want to bet I'm going to be hearing from these guys right away on account of what happened in the States on September 11th. And when I left there, I went home, and there was a registered letter for me at home, and they had set a date for an immigration inquiry. On September 20th, I went into the inquiry, and it lasted for a little more than 90 minutes, and they kept telling me, "Well, you have to claim Canadian citizenship." And I refused, and they said, "Well, are you a citizen of Canada?" They asked me, and I said, "No." And they said, "Well, you're a citizen of the United States." And I said, "No." And then just as a way to explain or to delineate the relationship between me and them, I said, "Well, I'm pre-Canadian." And I had no idea that that term was going to catch on. And if there wasn't a reporter from Leader Post sitting in the room who wrote it down and put it in a paper the next day, I wouldn't have even remembered that I used that term. So then they asked me, well, what country are you a citizen of? And I said, I'm a citizen of the Lakota Nation. And they were quiet for a while, and they said, well, look, if you claim Canadian citizenship, then all of this will go away. And I refused, and I have a copy of the transcripts from that meeting, and that was, for 90 minutes, that was the entire discussion. At first, the federal adjudicator tried to convince me to say I was Canadian. For a while there, they were just about begging me, and the adjudicator got upset. He called for a 10-minute recess. This was all on a picture tell thing. He was in Calgary, I think. I was in Regina. And when he left the room and the tape recorders were shut off, the lawyer for the government started pleading with me, tried to use my kids. Look, you got how many kids? You know, I understand, I sympathize with how you feel, but why don't you just tell him what he wants to hear when he comes back? And, you know, then he won't proceed to the next step. And I told him that I couldn't do that. I said, you brought my children up. You try to use my children as a tool to make me weak, but the way that I look at it is that my children, when they're grown up, they're going to look at how I handled this situation. And if I fold at this point, then I'm going to shame myself in front of my children. So even if I wanted to, I said, for my children's sake, I can't. Also, another concern is that I have two children who were born in Regina and two children who were born in Rapid City, South Dakota. Now, at the way that both of these countries are tightening up the border and attacking people on both sides, at any time, Canada could say, well, your two daughters that were born in Rapid City have to go back to South Dakota. There's nothing, you know, really preventing them from doing that. So for their benefit, I have to continue what I'm doing. Or if I move back to a more pleasant, warmer climate in South Dakota, then at any point, INS down there could say, well, your two sons have to go back to Saskatchewan. So really, for my children's sake, I have to continue what I'm doing. When the adjudicator came back into the room and tape recorders were turned back on again, he had a book with him, and he quoted from the Indian Act. And I should back up too. The reason that he left the room and got this book was that I challenged him to show me any documentation that proves that Canada has authority over Indigenous people, and you know, without an Indigenous person submitting to their authority. So he left. When he came back, he quoted from the Indian Act, and I said, "No, I said any valid document." I said, that act was that act was created by you for Indian people. I said, you don't have a Canadian English Act or a Canadian Iranian Act. You know, I said, this is ridiculous. I could leave right now. I could go home and I could come up with, the Turtle Island Caucasian Act and then come in and say, now this applies to you. I said, that's not a legal document. Then with that, he got angry. Then is when he started demanding that I claim Canadian citizenship and threatening me with, well, if you don't say that you're Canadian, then we're going to have to proceed to the next step. If you say you're a Canadian citizen, we don't have to proceed from here. But, you know, if you don't, and so this, like I said, lasted for more than an hour and a half. Finally, he got tired of trying to convince me, and so he said, we give you 30 days to leave Canada. Then with that, there were some papers to sign, and, you know, that was it. I went back, and I was trying to think of what I should do. My wife, at that point, started getting scared, and without asking me on her own, she phoned immigration offices, and she said, look, I'm a Canadian citizen. What if I support, or how do you say, sponsor my husband because I'm a Canadian citizen? Then Darcy Warner, one of the supervisors with immigration in Regina, said, well, it wouldn't matter. At this point, that wouldn't supersede the deportation order. Plus, Hattie said, you need a $10,000, you have to pay a $10,000 fee to sponsor someone. Do you have $10,000? then from there, the conversation kind of got worse. I walked into the room and I was asking her, well, who the heck are you talking to? And she's telling me, well, it's immigration and what the hell did they phone for? Well, no, I phoned them. And what did you do that for? Well, I was going to sponsor you. And anyways, she started arguing with him and she said, well, why don't you explain that to Charlie? No, I don't want to talk to him. Well, he's standing right here. You tell him. No, I don't want to talk to him. He wouldn't talk to me. And she said, well, what are you going to do if he doesn't leave? And Darcy Warner said, well, we'll arrest him and we'll detain him till we can find a way to send him back to the States. Or if we can't do that, then we'll send him to Pakistan. And I started asking around to see what the weather was like in Pakistan. And they told me just as cold as Canada, and it was approaching winter again. And so I wasn't real thrilled with this idea. I sat and I thought about this. And on the day before my deadline to leave what they call Canada, I phoned the Regina Leader Post, the local newspaper, and asked them if they wanted to do a story on this on the following day, you know, on my deadline. And they said, well, yeah, we'll be interested. And what are you going to do? And I said, you come to my house tomorrow and you'll find out. So when they came, I told them, you know, I said, I've had a month to think about this. And they offered me easy outs. Like one of the things that immigration told my wife was, well, look, all he has to do to satisfy this order is to just leave the country. He doesn't have to stay away. He can go down to Montana, have a cup of coffee in a cafe down there and come back, and he will have satisfied that order. Of course, I considered that, you know, because it was, you know, an easy way out. It was kind of silly, but it was, you know, a short-term solution. But then I had a hard time with allowing someone else to control me or to dictate my actions. And so I decided, no, I can't do that. So what I told the reporters was that I've been thinking about this for a year. Like I said earlier, I'm a biologist. And so I looked at this, you know, from a lot of different ways. And I thought, you know, there's prairie June grass, there's little blue stem buffalo grass growing on this side of the 49th parallel in Saskatchewan, the same exact grass going on that side of the 49th parallel. And I don't know, but I imagine there's even, you know, grasses that grow right exactly on top of that line. And then if you have other indigenous inhabitants of this land, like deer or pronghorn, for example, wandering around there, and they're not going to see any line, you know, they might eat some buffalo grass on the North Dakota side of that border, stroll across to the Saskatchewan side and defecate that grass on the north side of that border, and have no idea that they, you know, ingested this food on one side and then digested it on another side. And if there is a fence or some type of a barrier to the natural movement, then they'll go around it or just jump over it, because that's natural. You know, natural movement. That's the way somebody who's thinking with their own mind, you know, that's how they're going to behave. And then, like I said earlier, too, I've always thought that wildlife was a lot more intelligent than human species are. So then I started asking myself, well, then exactly what is Canada? And I figured that Canada is an enigma. Canada is something that exists only in the minds or the imagination of these colonizers. Canada is not a tangible entity. I was sitting outside in the back of my house giving this interview, and I picked up some spruce needles. I said, you know, my ancestors' blood and bodies have gone in to nourish this tree that's growing here. When your people came over here, I explained to him, you guys right away started sealing your bodies up in boxes when you get planted. So you're constantly taking things from this land, and when you're alive, you don't give nothing back. Now, even when you die, you don't give anything back to this land. And then even though most Indians are buried in coffins, sealed up like that now, throughout Canada, especially in the western provinces, there's still quite a few Indian women that are kidnapped by non-Indian men and beaten and killed and left to die in ditches and alongside lakes and in marshes. And their bodies are returning to the land and providing nourishment for these trees and these grasses to grow here. So scientifically speaking, I'm related to everything that's growing on this land, just like the spruce needles that I had in my hand. So I'm biologically related to this plant material. So with that, how can I leave Canada if it doesn't exist? And you can't see Canada, you can't see where it begins or ends. And seeing as how Canada is only in the minds of white people, the only way, no matter where I happen to live, the only way for me to leave Canada is for these white people to quit thinking about me. And then when I'm out of their minds, then, you know, I'll be out of Canada. But meanwhile, I'll still be here in this northern part of Turtle Island taking care of my family. So they asked me, well, what will you do if they come and arrest you like they've threatened? I said, well, if they arrest me and they handcuff me and they take me to this imaginary border on the 49th parallel and push me across to the south side of that line, as soon as they take the handcuffs off of me, then I'll turn around and walk back north again. And if they arrest me again, do the same thing, then I'll do the same thing, no matter how long it takes. That made it into the paper, of course, on the front page the next morning. Citizenship and Immigration didn't say anything. They waited for about 3 weeks, I think, and they sent me a registered letter in October last year ordering me to report to immigration offices for deportation. I think it was on Halloween last year. So then I looked at that and I thought about it, and I sent them back a letter, registered mail, and then I detailed the precise articles and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I think some famous document that some Canadian wrote and no Canadian follows anyways. And then also, even though it's not a legal document yet, I also took articles from the draft Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that Canada was in violation of. And I explained beneath each of those articles, I explained exactly how Canada was violating those international documents and its attack against me. And then I also brought up some illegal and immoral situations that Immigration Canada had been guilty of in dealing with me and their harassment of me since June 19th of 2001. And I demanded that Darcy Warner apologize to my wife for threatening to send me to Pakistan. And I reminded them that they had absolutely no authority or jurisdiction over me whatsoever. And I told them that they therefore had no authority to order me to come into their offices at any time for any reason, so that I wasn't going to report for deportation. And I told them that if the day should ever come, that they have the integrity and the honesty to deal with the situation in an equitable manner, that they know where I live and they can come see me and we'll talk this out like adults. And then I sent that off to them, registered mail, and they still haven't responded to it. So in January, they came. I was standing outside checking the oil on my car, and they arrested me, put the handcuffs on me behind my back. Well, told me that I was under arrest and I was going to be deported. And I told them, well, I need to get my jacket and I need to say goodbye to my kids. The three youngest kids were inside the house. I said, well, all right, we'll make it fast. Went inside, asked my wife to get my black jacket. And they said, well, okay, let's go now. And I said, no, I haven't said goodbye to my kids yet. And they said, well, no, we have no time. And I said, well, no, my daughters are standing here looking at you and they're scared. And you're not going to take me away like this. You're inside of my house, and I'm going to talk to my kids before I leave. So they each grabbed an arm, tried to pull me out. The guy on this side, there's like a doorway by my living room, and I accidentally moved kind of quick like that, and he somehow got dumped onto the box containing all the shoes. And then the bigger guy was using his weight on top of me, and it took a little bit more effort to accidentally shake him off. And then finally, somehow, his head hit the wooden like frame around the window. And then when his head bounced off of there, he let go of me. And so then I stood up and I said, now, you see, if you would have listened to me, we wouldn't have had to go through all this. And so then I told my daughters not to be scared in that. And suddenly kind of felt kind of full of myself, and I was kind of liking it. So then I took my time, asked my wife to get me a drink of water, and that, and so then I said, okay, let's go. They took me off. They put me in the RCMP barracks in Regina for a couple of days, told the jailers that I was to have no contact with anyone, and if anyone, the media, my family, whoever, phoned the jail, that they're ordered not to give them any information. Said that I wasn't allowed to make a phone call. Told them, what cell are you going to put him in? Make sure that there's no one on either cell, on either side of him. Then later on, I tried to get the phone. They said, well, you can't, you know, you can't use a phone because immigration said what I just told you. So, but what's your phone number? And I told them, and a jailer wrote it down. And so then some of the jailers at the RCMP barracks were, I guess, sympathetic or supportive of me. So they were phoning my wife to keep her abreast of what was going on. And this is how she knew when immigration was coming to pick me up. And as she notified the media beat us to the border at North Portal. When they took me down there, I believe it was around January 9th, took me to the border. They drove pretty fast. I tried to make a citizen's arrest. They wouldn't listen to me. They were doing about 150 going down that highway. We got down there and took me inside, and they took a piece of paper. They photocopied something from a book, the bad photocopy, and at the top there were three blanks. They typed my name and the first one, my date of birth, and then for place of birth they put USA, and the immigration agent that accompanied me to the border signed his name at the bottom. And when we got down there, I told the U.S. Customs guy, well, look, you know, how many days has it been since the bombings on September 11th? I'm not a Canadian citizen. You can't let me cross. And so then Agent Ronald Smith said, we got documentation that proves he's an American citizen. This is it right here. And I looked at it, and I laughed, and I said, look at the signature on the bottom of the page, and look at this guy's identification. This guy was too stupid to have someone else in his office sign this piece of paper. The U.S. immigration guy looked at it and he said, well, I'm not going to get involved in whatever's going on between you and Canada immigration. And we stayed there for about 4 hours. Canada immigration, the RCMP, was trying to convince this guy to let me through. They refused. They pulled the car around back. Finally, they snuck me out through the back door so that the media cameras wouldn't see them taking me back into the car. Went back north. We got to the Canadian customs, and immigration guys asked, can you give us a head start? And he said, you want me to delay the media? And he said, yeah. How much of a head start do you want? He said, well, I'll try and hang on to them for about half an hour. And then they took off driving just as fast back to Regina. They put me back in RCMP barracks, and after a couple of days, they realized that the way that my wife and the media knew what was going on is that someone from the RCMP barracks was leaking information to my wife. So they came without telling the jailers, without telling anyone. They came and said, well, we're going to transfer you. So then they transferred me to Regina Correctional Center. When they got me into a correctional center, they dropped me off there. I had to get changed into an orange monkey suit. I went in and I told the jailer, look, nobody knows that I've been moved over here. I need to make a phone call. And the jailer is looking at these papers. He said, well, it says here that you've been ordered into a maximum security unit and under 24-hour lockdown, and you're to have no contact with anyone. But it's going to take me a couple of minutes to process these papers, and there's a phone right over there. And he turned and walked into an office. So I went, picked up the phone, and phoned my wife right away. At that time, we had a cell phone. The first bills hadn't come in from our cell phone yet, so we still had a cell phone until the bill came in. It just so happened that CBC Radio was in the house at that time, and then also my wife called Regina Leader Post newspaper, and she had, you know, one phone to each ear talking to me, to CBC, and to Leader Post. I told him I had been moved and what was going on. I told her that at that time I was going to start a hunger strike because of what Canada was doing to me. And, of course, this made it into the newspaper the next morning. They set up a detention hearing for, I believe it was around January 11th this year, where immigration was going to ask a federal adjudicator to give them permission to keep me locked up indefinitely. My wife and one of my sisters started a calling people. They organized a rally the day before this detention hearing day. They called enough people, and they had about 50 people standing out there in the cold. It's a public building, but immigration locked the doors when they saw all these people coming up for this rally. They went into the hearing, and quite a bit of the media showed up also, pressured the government. And the government lawyer tried to explain that they needed permission to lock me up because I was an escape risk. And as the judge pointed out, well, when you told this guy to leave, he refused to leave, so what exactly makes him an escape risk? So with that, they said, well, he uses a number of aliases. My friends call me Wolf. Okay, so they said, sometimes he goes by Charlie Wolf, sometimes he goes by Wolf Smoke, sometimes just Wolf. And they said, also he has an extensive jail record. And so they got my jail record going back more than 20 years, back to when I was a teenager. But what they did was they changed the dates on all of those arrests to make them appear that they had all occurred in the past 3 to 5 years. And they named them off, you know, this year, but, you know, the year was wrong. He got arrested for going on and on. And they said, and also he spent time behind bars in Regina before. But then they didn't explain that what happened was that when I lived in Regina several years before that, I was arrested on 2 parking tickets that I had already paid. I got 5 days in jail in a correctional center for those 2 parking tickets. Every day my wife went to City Hall and said, look, he paid his tickets before. They said, we can't find proof in a computer. The day after I got released, I went back to City Hall to the individual that I had paid, you know, given the money to. And as soon as I told him, he looked in his computer. Oh, it's right here. I guess someone just forgot to take the paperwork upstairs. Of course, I didn't have any money to hire a lawyer, but that's why I had been in jail previously in Regina. Of course, the government's lawyer didn't explain that to the adjudicator. So I was released. Immigration was kind of upset that the adjudicator released me. So they said, well, okay, then we want a $1,000 bond. And this was late in the afternoon on a Friday, about, quarter to 4, quarter to 5, whatever time. This was about 15 minutes before everything was going to close. The people that had been at the rally were still waiting out front. And so my sister ran outside and said, okay, we need $1,000 right now. And so she grabbed one of my buddy's hats and broke into everybody's bingo money, and they raised, within less than 5 minutes, they got $480. And NDP Minister of Parliament said, well, I'll get the rest. He went around the corner to his ATM and took out $520. I was sure that I was spending the weekend in jail, and they came back. Not even 10 minutes after they had left the room, they came back in with $1,000 and gave that to them, and so I was released. I should have talked slower.